I think I've got it all set up now. thanks, and I'm very glad to have made it. The skies didn't actually part. It was still snowing up there, but there was a huge queue for the planes that were waiting to get de-iced up in Boston, and word has it that half of them were bound for Minnesota. You may have heard the Patriots are in the Super Bowl. I don't know if you've heard that. So anyway, I am delighted to be here. I'm going to talk a little bit about interoperability and context as well. There's a little bit of overlap with what Chris talked about, but you know, I'll dive into a little bit more detail in just sort of describing in broad brushes, you know, kind of my perspective on where we are with respect to clinical interoperability. That can hopefully be a good launching point for a good discussion during the Q&A. I will just say before I launch in, I'm actually really sanguine about where we are in interoperability. I know you don't hear that very often in many forums. And the reason I am is, you know, sort of a couple of things. One is that I think that we keep moving the goalposts, which is a good thing, right? We want to keep moving forward. You heard Dr. Rucker say before that, oh, we've defined clinical interoperability too narrowly, that we need to broaden the definition. The 21st Century Cures does that. But, you know, what I will say from a layperson's perspective, I spent the weekend with a group of college friends who we get together every year, and I asked them one night, and it had nothing to do with the fact that a few beers had been, you know, had gone past. I asked them, if I were to say to you that within the next 2 to 3 years, we were going to have networks live and in production so that most provider organizations in the country could securely send a medical record summary to most other providers in the country, or I should say, and they also could request a record, your record, from most other providers in the country and get it back. Would you say that we have achieved nationwide interoperability? And to a person, they all said, yeah, absolutely. That's what I want from nationwide interoperability. And as I'm going to describe, we're pretty close to that. We're actually implementing that right now. So that's one, you know, point of context I think it's really important for us to take stock of. And that's not to say that we're done or that it's going to solve all the issues that we want with the learning healthcare system and all the things with patient access and the other things that we're talking about. But I think it's really important to take stock of where we are because a tremendous amount of progress has been made. And it also points to the difficulties that are, you know, we've both sort of tackled but also lie ahead. And it's not about technology. So, you know, the first thing to just take stock of, and Chris did, you know, talk about a few of these, so I won't belabor the point. There are just a couple of things that I would point to in my points here. One is that we all just need to recognize, you know, when do we start the clock ticking? Because for most of the time that people like to say that we had no interoperability, people didn't have EHRs. I mean, EHRs are a very recent phenomenon, right? In the early 2000s, when I was working out in Indianapolis, launching the Indiana Health Information Exchange, 10% of physician practices had electronic health record systems. And with hospitals, it was something like 20, 25%, right? Whatever that number was. And you can't have phone networks without phones. You can't have ATM networks without ATMs. So, you know, I think we really need to be cognizant of the fact that EHRs are a relatively recent phenomenon, meaning widely used and, you know, and sort of a standard part of clinical care in most settings. The other thing that I would point out, and you know that, and it's still a feature of the industrial landscape in healthcare delivery, is that healthcare is unlike almost every other sector in the U.S. in that it's got extremely fragmented on the supply side and the demand side, and so that means that it's very hard to get IT to sort of change in very short period of time, you know, sort of the kinds of sweeping changes we see in retail, marketing, airlines, whatever it is. In almost all of those sectors, including banking, you had concentration of companies that at some point were able to get together and start to make, you know, sort of IT the kinds of change force that it was. Because it also requires alignment of incentives, alignment of workflows, alignment of processes before you can really have technology be the great enabler there. So healthcare really is different, and not just for the reasons that we think about because, you know, because it's medicine and medicine's really difficult. The other thing I would point to is the bottom one, which is, you know, and I don't mean to, you know, say that consumers are completely indifferent, but, you know, one of the things that I think is very difficult in all of this is that we want to and we need to provide greater and greater access so that patients are able to exert their right of access to their medical records, right? That's absolutely true. And I think that, you know, that's a part of all of our mission. And as you'll see with, you know, when I talk about with the Argonaut Project and other things, that is a core part of what those are about. On the other hand, I think it's probably most of your experiences, certainly mine, that most patients really don't want to be actively engaged with that, and they don't really know what to do with their data. And it's not clear that they want to have their data in the same way that we want to have our banking data and our Fitbit data and, you know, and data on the, you know, schedule with my health club and whatever else it is. So that's a little bit of a challenge as we think about what does it mean to have consumer access, and are consumers really going to bite and, you know, be the drivers of the changes that we'd like to see in the same way that they are in other sectors, because there's a very different dynamic there. And again, going back to this small ad hoc focus group I had this weekend, I described to them what the Apple iPhone is going to do, and they were pretty underwhelmed. I mean, it was like, oh, well, that's it? I mean, I actually don't even want my records on my phone. I don't even know what I would do with them on my phone. Now, maybe that, you know, just sort of speaks to Steve Jobs, you know, old saying that customers don't know what they want, and 10 years from now we'll realize that Apple actually figured it out. But right now, I think, you know, and but none of us thinks of that as an endpoint, right? It's not an endpoint. It's the first very, very important step, and I'm certainly not here to diminish that, you know, the Apple announcement, because I think it's hugely important. But I think there is a whole piece to this on the consumer side that none of us, literally none of us, really understand. We don't know where it's going. We're making lots of assumptions that's going to be a huge driver. We actually don't know that. So one of the things I want to talk about, I just have two slides, is a short history of EHR interoperability. It may be a little bit different than what you see. First off, it starts in 2010, please note, and I stole this shamelessly from some tweets and other conversation I've had with Arian Malik from Relay Health, who some of you may know. But, you know, I sort of thought about the different things that we've been involved in over the years, and I start the clock ticking around 2010, in part because that's when you started to see the glimmers of, wow, we could have real penetration of EHR systems as meaningful use was coming around, and there were some other activities. But, you know, there's the Markle Foundation started back in 2010, coined the term blue button at a meeting in, I think it was January 2010, or it might have been late 2009. As a way to, you know, sort of enable patient access. So, you know, so there it was, you know, sort of that inkling of, wow, we ought to be able to, you know, have these EHR systems make data available to patients, you know, kind of a novel thing. And as many of you know, Blue Button was, you know, very primitive by our current standards, but, you know, but it was there. And then in 2012, we started having view, download, transmit, included in meaningful use and EHR certification. And, oh, by the, on the left-hand side, I've put the EHR penetration rates there, just to give a point of context as well in time. So it wasn't really until 2013, 2014 that you had 50% of providers having an electronic health record in the first place. Right? That's 4 or 5 years ago. Very short period of time. So you had HL7 in 2011 starting to say, you know what? There's probably something we need to do in the way in the standards of bringing them up to modern internet conventions, because the standards that we use today aren't getting widely adopted. They are cumbersome. They are specific to healthcare, and there's probably a different way of thinking about this. In 2012, view, download, transmit became a part of production EHR systems, meaning that patients would now have the ability through their certified systems to be able to view, download, or transmit their own records. FHIR development started. So FHIR, which is that, you know, open API concept based on the RESTful API that that Don was talking about, the development really just started in 2011, 2012. Really, not very long ago. So fast forward, JSON Task Force that I co-chaired with Dr. David McCauley, the Argonaut Project starts. APIs get included in meaningful use in EHR certification. APIs, Argonaut implementation guides are published. 2017, Commonwealth and Care Quality announced that they're going to be connecting their networks. And then finally, 2018, the Apple Argonaut Project, FHIR specifications. The only reason I wanted to lay out that timeline a little bit is to point out that, you know, here we are from a glimmer in 2010 of perhaps patients might be able to access something in EHR systems that, that only 10% of provider organizations have, or whatever the number is, 16 or 26% of provider organizations have these things, and we have this hope that maybe patients will have some kind of access, to a short 8 years later, and Apple is saying that we're going to make these available on your device in whatever that term is, with 21st century cure, simple and no special effort or whatever that is, right? I mean, I think that by any measure, that is a pretty fast, you know, development in a really complicated sector of the economy. So I want to make sure that, you know, so we take stock of that. Last thing I just want to point out is, you know, where are we with respect to the way interoperability is unfolding and with clinical interoperability as narrowly defined right now? So the first is we've got, you know, sort of networks. So let me back up here for a second. So networks are hugely important, right? In anything that we're talking about, this doesn't happen without networks. And if you think about the way telephone networks have emerged, and you think about ATM networks and all sorts of other networks that were very organic. They developed from the bottom up, from organizations getting together. They had similar, you know, with participants, business users, people who had certain affinity. They decided they were going to get together, decide a set of rules, and then implement a set of technologies to do the kinds of things that they wanted to do. And that started to grow organically. In the beginning of the last century, like around, you know, 1901, 1902, there were 2 million phone users in the U.S. About two-thirds of them were on the AT&T network, a single network. One-third of them were on 2,000 independent networks, right? 1,000 of them, one-third of them were on 2,000 independent networks. And it took something like 50 to 60 years for that to shake out into the more rationalized, you know, kind of interoperability, interoperable phone networks that we see today. So, you know, I would submit to you that's kind of where we are today, that you're, you know, just in the phase of an industry that you're starting to see that network formation and rationalization starting to happen. So with respect to push, which is a major part of, you know, of healthcare interaction pattern. I think that's going to be here for a very long time. Just, I want to be able to send something to you. That's it. That's all I want to do. It's a very simple transaction, secure email. We've got Direct Trust, which is a nationwide network organization that isn't perfect. Direct isn't perfect, but you're seeing more and more use of it, more and more activity day by day. And then we have Query and Retrieve. Commonwealth and Care Quality announced that they're going to be connecting those networks. They announced that pre-TEFCA, pre-21st century cures. There's a lot of work to get there, but that's like AT&T and Verizon saying that they're going to be connecting their networks. That's now an implementation this year. And then finally, we've got bottom-up, and we don't know where that goes, but bottom-up is the consumer-enabled thing that I was, that, you know, that Apple maybe, you know, sort of have broken the dam in that with respect to patients being able to do that on their phone. And that may be the wave of the future in terms of a Copernican revolution kind of approach where we think of, you know, patients actually being the real stewards of their information and allowing access to that information, but more under their control. Obviously, a lot would have to happen between now and then for that to happen. So I'll stop here and look forward to the discussion.
Thank you, Mickey.